Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Tuesday, June 9th, 2026, for our Commodities and Energy edition.
Our central thesis today focuses on the intensifying competition for foundational resources, as the unprecedented capital expenditure required to scale global AI infrastructure begins to collide with longstanding supply-side constraints. We are moving away from an era of predictable energy costs toward a period of structural, demand-driven volatility.
Essentially, the digital revolution is hitting a massive physical wall.
So here's the picture. That wall is built from the massive power requirements of next-generation data centers.
We begin our analysis by examining the great CapEx surge and the urgent race to power the AI boom. Alphabet is currently executing an $80 billion secondary offering, which is a rather polite way of saying they are raiding their own shareholders to pay for more concrete and copper.
It's part of a much larger, much more expensive pivot. You're witnessing a fundamental structural shift from an asset-light software model to an asset-heavy industrial one, where the Magnificent Seven are moving from high-margin, capital-light businesses to massive, capital-intensive infrastructure plays.
It sounds like the tech industry is suddenly very interested in being a construction company.
In many ways, they are. We're seeing a massive CapEx surge where the primary driver isn't just code, but the physical capacity to run it. We are looking at a projected $3 trillion in infrastructure spending over the next 3 years. The scale of this is unprecedented. Companies like Google are projecting annual spends of roughly $200 billion.
Which is lovely, provided they actually make something with all that spending. I mean, spending $3 trillion to perhaps generate, what, $80 billion in revenue? That's a slightly optimistic way to run a business.
That is exactly the fear. On capital allocators, Rajiv Jain of GQG Partners pointed out a dangerous capital-to-revenue imbalance. He noted that the projected $3 trillion in spending is not being matched by proportional revenue growth, which could fundamentally erode the free cash flow of these tech giants. We're seeing the Magnificent Seven trade their legendary margins for a massive, expensive buildout.
So we have a massive spending spree with a very uncertain return on investment. And I assume the bottleneck isn't just the money.
No, the bottleneck has physically moved. If you look at the recent Odd Lots discussion, the industry bottleneck has shifted from semiconductor scarcity to what they call the powered shell problem. It doesn't matter if you have the latest NVIDIA Blackwell or Vera Rubin chips if you don't have a building that is energized, cooled, and equipped to house them.
So it's not about who has the best AI, it's about who has the most reliable transformer and the biggest air conditioner.
It's a race for physical real estate and grid access. We are seeing extreme density in places like Ashburn, Virginia, where there are 150 data centers serving a population of only 50,000 residents. This creates a massive secondary demand for everything: specialized electrical labor, liquid cooling systems for the new 72 GPU chassis architectures, and most critically, massive amounts of raw power.
And that's where the commodities traders start getting excited, I suppose.
The pattern is clear. This is a massive picks and shovels effect for the energy sector. The demand for electricity is undergoing an unprecedented upward revision. Analysts at 451 Research are forecasting a jump in U.S. data center power demand from about 64 gigawatts in 2025 to over 183 gigawatts by 2030. That is nearly a tripling of the demand in just 5 years.
Which sounds like a wonderful way to ensure that the lights stay on in my house, provided I don't mind a slightly higher utility bill.
Actually, the revenue from these large-scale industrial users might be the only way to fund the upgrade. The argument is that the increased revenue from data centers can act as a subsidy for grid modernization, allowing utilities to fund necessary infrastructure upgrades without shifting the entire capital burden onto residential ratepayers.
A lovely way to frame a utility rate hike. But surely, if the grid is the bottleneck, we just build more renewable energy.
It's complicated. While there is a massive push for renewables, the sheer scale of the baseload requirement for these clusters is driving a resurgence in gas-fired power demand. You can't run a massive inference cluster on intermittent wind alone. We are seeing a strategic pivot in the utility sector. For example, the massive NextEra-Dominion transaction is seen by analysts like Oliver Barnes as a move toward providing unregulated power specifically to meet this data center demand.
So we are building massive, high-cost, gas-powered infrastructure to support a digital revolution that might not even pay for itself.
There is a significant risk of that. And the competition is getting much more aggressive. In the energy sector, the difficulty of obtaining regulatory approvals for pipelines and transmission lines is creating a new kind of moat. True quality in investing might now be found in companies that control the physical bottlenecks, the energy and the transmission, rather than just the software.
Even in the UK, they're trying to solve this with geography.
Right.
Redefining energy highlighted a strategic shift toward north-to-south load balancing. In the UK, there's a push to place data centers in Scotland to tap into existing northern renewable generation and avoid the massive transmission constraints found in the south.
It's a global game of musical chairs, but the chairs are all massive, energy-hungry servers.
And the music is getting much louder and more expensive. Even the way these companies finance the build-out is changing. If you look at CoreWeave, they are using an asset co-financing model via special purpose vehicles. They take long-term take-or-pay contracts from clients and pair them with debt amortization schedules. They are essentially turning specialized GPU infrastructure into a predictable, investment-grade credit instrument.
It's all very clever until the take-or-pay clients realize they're paying for electricity they don't need.
That brings us to the shift from training to inference. The initial land grab was about training massive models, which is computationally intensive but episodic. Now we are entering the era of sustained inference demand, the day-to-day running of these models. This is much more constant, much more power-intensive, and it's where the real strain on the electrical grid will be felt.
The war on oil is being replaced by a war on compute, where GPUs and memory are the new essential commodities.
That is exactly how some are framing it. Momike has compared the current AI landscape to a war on oil, where compute power is the new global commodity. But there's an inflationary shadow here too. As we've discussed, the massive simultaneous capital expenditures by all major players, from hyperscalers to quantitative trading firms, could lead to a zero-margin equilibrium. If everyone is using the same hardware and the same energy-intensive infrastructure, the competitive advantage of the software gets competed away by the rising cost of the electricity required to run it.
It's an arms race where the price of the bullets is rising faster than the value of the territory you're conquering.
That's a perfect way to put it. You're seeing a period where the animal spirits are so strong that traditional valuation metrics are being rendered obsolete by unprecedented margin guides, yet we are simultaneously seeing a massive, structural inflationary driver. This high-cost build-out in semiconductors, energy, and construction labor is a fundamental input into the broader cost of doing business.
Investors in the utility and energy sectors need to watch how quickly regulators approve these new transmission lines. Keep an eye on the quarterly power demand revisions from the major cloud providers. But this massive physical scramble for energy and hardware is really starting to change the way we think about the cost of everything. I was reading about the future of higher education costs this morning, and apparently, if you want a Penn education in 18 years, you should probably start saving for a small sovereign wealth fund, because it's projected to hit $800,000. It's almost impressive, at this rate, the only way to afford a degree is to strike it rich in a mid-tier commodities hedge fund.
It's the same structural math playing out in the broader economy, Maya. We are moving away from that era of predictable, demand-driven inflation into something much more volatile, a supply-side regime. Everything from energy to food is being reshaped by physical constraints, rather than just how much money people are spending.
Right, so instead of too much money chasing too few goods, it's more like not enough goods, regardless of how much money I have. The death of the 2% inflation target.
Two things stand out. And it's not just a feeling, the plumbing of the energy markets is physically changing. Take the US gasoline market right now. According to Argus Media, we saw a massive 16% drop in May stocks, double the historical five-year average, yet we didn't see a summer scarcity panic.
Why?
Because increased imports and pipeline flows created a localized supply overhang in New York Harbor. The supply and demand fundamentals are essentially decoupling.
So the headline number looks like a shortage, but the actual barrels are just sitting in a different warehouse. It's a bit like seeing an empty fridge when the grocery store just happens to have a massive surplus in the loading dock.
Worth noting, there's a hidden squeeze happening in the chemistry of that gasoline. As we transition from winter to summer specifications, the way we blend fuel is getting much more complicated. Argus Media points out that as butane shares drop from 8% to 2% to meet lower RVP requirements, blenders have to rely much more on reformate. This forces more heavy naphtha into the reformers, which creates a secondary supply strain.
So we're trading one problem for another. We get the volume we need, but the quality of the pool degrades.
That's the byproduct paradox. Even if lower cracker runs mean more naphtha is available for gasoline, it simultaneously restricts the supply of essential high-octane components like alkylate and pyrolysis gasoline. You gain the volume, but you lose the chemical potency needed to maintain octane levels. It's a structural bottleneck.
This sounds like the central bank is trying to fix a broken engine by adjusting the thermostat. If the problem is the physical composition of the fuel, does the Federal Reserve even have a tool for that?
That is the billion-dollar question. On Bloomberg Intelligence, Ira Jersey and Eric Vanestrand of Lazard have been discussing how the Fed's conventional tools are fundamentally poorly suited for this. The Fed manages demand, interest rates make borrowing more expensive to slow spending. But how do you use an interest rate to fix a shortage of alkylate or to mitigate the impact of geopolitical instability in the Middle East on crude prices?
You can't.
So the Fed is essentially playing a game of whack-a-mole where the moles are made of unrefined crude oil.
And the stakes are rising. We're seeing a shift toward a hiking bias because these supply shocks are driving inflation expectations higher. In the May jobs report, we saw a decoupling that actually serves as a structural deflationary mechanism. Wage growth was 3 and 4%, while inflation was at 3.8%. Because wages aren't rising fast enough to cover the price increases, we aren't seeing second-round effects. Workers aren't yet aggressively bargaining for higher pay to offset the energy costs.
So as long as everyone stays too broke to demand a raise, the inflationary spiral stays contained. That feels like a very precarious way to run an economy.
It is.
If we hit a period of reflation where growth and inflation both rise, the Fed can use hikes to manage the tight labor market. But the real fear is stagflation, high inflation paired with low growth. If energy prices spike for 6 to 12 months due to the current tensions between Iran and Israel, it could trigger a permanent shift in global inflation expectations.
Which brings us back to the pressure cooker scenario. If the Fed keeps the squeeze on to fight supply-driven inflation, they might accidentally trigger the very demand destruction they're trying to avoid.
The incoming Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, is walking a tightrope. He has to balance the need for restrictive policy to curb supply-driven inflation against the risk of crashing the economy through high energy costs. And even the way we view the relationship between assets is changing. On Bloomberg Surveillance, Lisa Shannon suggested that because stocks and bonds are now both responding to these same technological and inflationary drivers, they no longer provide effective diversification. You're essentially holding two different versions of the same trade.
Which means the only way to find actual ballast is to move into real assets, commodities, energy infrastructure, the stuff you can actually touch.
There's a signal here: the era of low inflation, steady growth, stability is effectively over. We are in a high uncertainty regime where the term premium is rising. Even in the oil markets, we're seeing geopolitical supervolatility. The idea is that price spikes will force demand down to match available supply, followed by sharp pullbacks, leaving an average oil price higher than what the long end of the futures curve suggests.
It makes the entire equity market look incredibly vulnerable. If the market is mispricing oil equities by treating excess cash flows as having no value, they are missing the point of a high volatility environment.
In this environment, a dollar of free cash flow should be valued at face value, especially for the top-tier producers. If you are a company in the top two profitability quartiles, that cash is your shield against the volatility.
It sounds like the era of set it and forget it investing is dead, replaced by a need to constantly monitor the chemical composition of gasoline and the geopolitical stability of the Middle East.
It's much more granular now. You can't just look at aggregate GDP, you have to look at the drivers. Even the Fed's 2025 framework review was criticized for a diagnostic error. As noted in Macro Musings with David Beckworth, the FOMC treated the 2021 to 2022 inflation as a supply shock, when in reality, nominal GDP had already returned to trend by April 2021. If they misdiagnose the driver, they apply the wrong medicine.
And if the medicine is a rate hike that kills demand while energy prices are already crushing it, the patient doesn't just recover, they collapse.
That is the fundamental tension. We are watching a transition from a world where inflation was a symptom of too much heat in the engine to a world where inflation is caused by a lack of fuel in the tank.
Energy investors need to stop looking at interest rate projections and start looking at refinery throughput and geopolitical flashpoints.
The real signal will be whether the May jobs report's trend of wage inflation decoupling breaks, because if workers finally start successfully bargaining for higher pay, the Fed's options disappear.
But as the supply lines tighten, all eyes are turning toward the bottleneck at the mouth of the Persian Gulf. If you were looking at your energy portfolio today, would you be more worried about a sudden price spike or the fact that the Strait of Hormuz is essentially becoming a high-stakes toll road managed by whoever has the most drones?
It's a bit of both, Maya, because we aren't just looking at a simple blockade, but a fundamental restructuring of how commodities move. We are seeing the emergence of the Persian Gulf as a de facto strategic petroleum reserve, where hundreds of trapped vessels act as a massive, inaccessible stockpile of dead oil that only enters the active commercial market if Iran permits passage.
So the oil is there, it's just sitting in a maritime parking lot waiting for a permit. That is peak geopolitical absurdity.
It's even more complicated than that. According to Argus Media, Iran is attempting to bypass international legal scrutiny by rebranding illegal maritime tolls as service fees for things like mine clearing, essentially trying to mimic the Bosphorus model to make the costs more palatable. They are using the PGSA to claim rights outside the traditional 12 nautical mile innocent passage protections.
And I assume the U.S. is just letting them service their way into a monopoly.
Not exactly. The U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control has already sanctioned the PGSA, which creates a massive divergence in shipping behavior. While container ship owners are testing dangerous routes for the sake of speed, tanker and dry bulk owners are increasingly willing to absorb the cost of much longer, safer detunes. This is creating a massive supply-side shock. Rory Johnston noted that if this disruption persists through the end of summer, we could see oil prices surge toward $150 per barrel as global inventories are depleted.
But wait, if China's imports have absolutely cratered, doesn't that act as a pressure valve for the rest of the world?
It does, but in a very destabilizing way. Macro Voices highlighted that China's 50% collapse in crude imports, dropping from 12 million to 6 million barrels per day, effectively offsets the entire supply shock of the Hormuz closure. This makes China a more potent global supply balancer than OPEC. However, the structural risk remains high. We are seeing a persistent short position in the global market because 20% of Persian Gulf exports are still disrupted by this conflict.
So we have a massive amount of dead oil in the Gulf, a Chinese demand vacuum, and a U.S. administration caught between Trump promising a deal and Rubio demanding total Iranian withdrawal.
We can trace that further. The Trump administration has suggested the Iran embargo could lift by Labor Day in September, but the recent strikes on the U.S. Fifth Fleet headquarters and Kuwaiti infrastructure suggest Iran is pursuing escalation dominance. If the Strait of Bab al-Mandeb also closes, the bypasses we are relying on now will vanish instantly.
Investors in the tanker market need to reevaluate the viability of mainstream shipping routes through the Gulf. Watch for any shift in the shadow fleet volume, because if the PGSA's fees become a functional reality despite sanctions, the entire structure of global maritime insurance is at risk. But if the energy supply chains are this fragile, I wonder how much more pressure the global food supply can take from these same disruptions. We're looking at a massive tug of war in the commodities space right now. On one side, you have a global demand for food security, and on the other, a supply chain that looks like it's being systematically dismantled by geopolitics. Which side are you betting on for the fertilizer market?
It's a tough call because the supply side is facing a perfect storm of structural breaks. Argus Media reports that the closure of the Strait of Hormuz has forced Saudi Arabia to reroute phosphate logistics from the Mideast Gulf to Red Sea ports like Yanbu and Neom, which significantly increases export difficulty and shrinks global capacity.
It's not just a delay, it's a total re-engineering of the map. It's like trying to run a global delivery service, but suddenly all the main highways are closed, and you're forced to use narrow, congested side streets.
Something to flag here, it gets worse for phosphate. With Kazakhstan's sulfur supply blocked, Morocco's OCP could see production drop by as much as 50% due to maintenance and raw material shortages. Meanwhile, China has essentially pulled the plug on exports of DAP and MAP to prioritize their domestic market, and analysts don't expect those offers to return until 2027.
Great. So we have a massive supply vacuum paired with a sudden spike in transport costs. What about potash?
The volatility is just moving upstream. Zio Hugin noted that rising freight rates from the U.S.-Iran war are driving down potash netback levels to as low as $275 per ton. Even though China's MOP imports rose 24% year-on-year this spring, their port inventories are critically low because NPK producers are absorbing arrivals faster than they can stock up.
It's a massive squeeze on the margins.
It really is. Even in Australia, where phosphate prices have been somewhat insulated, the rising costs of sulfur and acid are creating a floor for long-term domestic price firmness.
Australian importers are now caught between a rock and a hard place.
Precisely.
Large-scale buyers must now decide if the premium for distant, high-risk shipments is worth the inventory gamble. Keep an eye on China's next move for MOP procurement. But all of this market chaos makes you wonder if we're seeing the end of the fossil fuel era or just a frantic pivot toward the stability of nuclear power. $465 million. That is the amount Helion Energy just secured for fusion power, and it is a staggering figure for a technology that is still effectively a scientific experiment.
It's part of a massive capital concentration into what Sightline Climate calls deep tech with a climate lens, where the primary value proposition is actually economic utility and profitability, not just decarbonization. We are seeing this across the board, from Spiro's $215 million for electric mobility to EaseVolta's $250 million for energy storage, all driven by a structural shift in energy markets.
We're just throwing billions at the sun to see if it works, hoping it prevents a total grid collapse, avoids a massive spike in data center energy costs, and eventually allows me to charge my phone using nothing but stardust.
It's less about stardust and more about immediate supply crises. The Trump administration is pushing for a 10-gigawatt nuclear expansion to meet the unprecedented electricity demand from AI data centers, using a parallel rather than series NRC review process to shorten construction timelines by nearly 9 months. The strategy is essentially a gas-to-nuclear business model, where utilities use natural gas as a temporary bridge to meet immediate data center loads while simultaneously building long-term nuclear infrastructure.
But building a nuclear plant isn't exactly like ordering a pizza. It feels like we're stuck in a loop of bespoke disasters.
The data tells a story. Columbia Energy Exchange noted that the failure of the Western nuclear model is fundamentally a failure of scale, where building one-off first-of-a-kind reactors leads to systemic cost overruns, unlike China's fleet approach. The real bottleneck isn't just regulation, it's the lack of financeable projects with finalized designs that can actually operate within a 3-year window.
So the utilities are trapped between needing massive gigawatt reactors for efficiency and small modular units for lower capital risk.
It's a strategic tension between economies of scale and economies of production.
The Department of Energy's ability to authorize pilot-scale demonstrations will determine if these unproven designs ever reach a commercial scale. Keep an eye on the next round of 123 agreement negotiations, because any new restrictions on enrichment could hand the long-term energy market to China and Russia. As we wrap up this edition, the common thread is clear. We are witnessing a fundamental realignment of global value. The digital revolution has outgrown its software origins and is now colliding with the hard limits of the physical world. We've moved from a period where growth was driven by code to an era where growth is dictated by the availability of copper, concrete, and kilowatts.
This isn't just about tech companies spending more. It's about a structural pivot in the global economy where the bottleneck has moved from the processor to the power grid. The single most critical implication here is for the Trump administration's energy policy. The proposed 10-gigawatt nuclear expansion isn't just a climate or domestic policy move. It is a direct response to a massive capital expenditure surge that threatens to outpace our current generation capacity. For the White House, the calculus has shifted from managing energy prices to managing the very foundation of industrial and computational sovereignty. If they cannot accelerate the deployment of massive, reliable baseload power, the $3 trillion infrastructure pipeline we're seeing could actually become a driver of systemic, supply-driven inflation rather than a driver of productivity.
It places a tremendous amount of pressure on the regulatory and physical plumbing of our energy markets to keep pace with the hunger of the data center.
As we navigate this period of intense reconfiguration, the one signal to watch is the upcoming regulatory progress on new high-voltage transmission line approvals in the U.S. If we see significant delays or denials in these permits, it will confirm that the hardware requirements of the AI boom are officially hitting a physical ceiling, potentially forcing a much more expensive and volatile scramble for localized fossil fuel-heavy energy solutions.
That's a heavy note to end on. Thanks for joining us for this week's Commodities and Energy Digest. We'll see you next Tuesday.